Chapter 17. The Arithmetic of Tomorrow. The Unforgiving Mathematics. The mathematics of compound interest is unforgiving. It is one of the simplest and most powerful forces in finance, and one of its most dangerous. If you lend $100 at 5% interest and the interest compounds, you have $163 after 10 years, $265 after 20, $432 after 30, $1,147 after 50, and $13,150 after 100. The expansion is exponential, not linear. The longer the time horizon, the more dramatic the outcome. The rule of 72 gives a useful shortcut. At 5%, money doubles roughly every 14.4 years, at 10% every 7.2 years, at 20% every 3.6 years. The same arithmetic applies to government debt. Consider a government with $100 billion in debt, at 4% interest. If it does nothing to reduce the principal, the debt grows to approximately $149 billion in 10 years, $222 billion in 20, $324 billion in 30, $480 billion in 40, and $711 billion in 50. The government does not need to issue new debt for this to happen. Existing debt compounds by itself. That creates a fundamental requirement. For debt to remain manageable, the economy must grow at least as fast as the debt burden. If the economy grows at 3% while debt grows at 4%, the debt-to-GDP ratio tends to rise. If the economy grows at 3% while debt grows at 2%, it tends to fall. 1 percentage point can make an enormous difference over decades. The problem is that economic growth cannot be guaranteed. It depends on productivity, demographics, technology, resources, investment, and ecological stability. If growth slows, debt becomes harder to carry. If growth stops, the assumptions underlying a growth-dependent financial system are tested. The R greater than G dynamic. The French economist Thomas Piketty popularized the relationship between the rate of return on capital, R, and the rate of economic growth, G. In his framework, when R greater than G, wealth held in capital can grow faster than the economy as a whole. Over time, this can increase the concentration of wealth. The relationship is not a universal law. It is a historical and economic observation, and its effects depend on taxation, saving, inheritance, asset prices, productivity, and other factors. But the underlying arithmetic matters for debt as well. When the effective interest rate on government debt exceeds the growth rate of the economy, debt can grow faster than national income. The debt-to-GDP ratio then becomes harder to stabilize. That is the deeper problem. Financial claims can compound independently of the physical economy that ultimately supports them. When returns consistently outrun the economy's capacity to generate income, wealth can accumulate faster than the productive base beneath it. The resulting imbalance is not necessarily a crisis today. It is a problem that compounds over time. The debt-to-GDP ratio. The debt-to-GDP ratio is one of the simplest measures of debt sustainability. Its movement depends mainly on three variables. The primary deficit, government spending minus revenue, excluding interest payments. The interest rate, the effective rate paid on government debt. The growth rate, the rate at which nominal GDP grows. A simplified version of the debt dynamics is delta of D over Y equals D over Y times R minus G, plus deficit over Y. Where delta of D over Y is the change in the debt-to-GDP ratio, D over Y is the existing debt-to-GDP ratio, R is the effective interest rate, G is the nominal GDP growth rate, and deficit is the primary government deficit. In plain English, the debt ratio tends to rise when interest costs exceed economic growth or when the government runs a primary deficit. It tends to fall when growth exceeds interest costs or when the government runs a primary surplus. The formula becomes especially important at high debt levels because the existing debt itself magnifies the effect of the R minus G difference. If R greater than G, even a balanced primary budget may not be enough to stabilize the ratio. That is the arithmetic governments eventually have to confront. The tipping point. Debt does not have one universal tipping point. A debt to GDP ratio that is manageable for one country may be dangerous for another. The outcome depends on interest rates, growth, currency arrangements, maturity structures, fiscal credibility, institutional strength, and investor confidence. The important variable is not simply the size of the debt. It is the relationship between the debt and the economy's capacity to service it. At high debt levels, a worsening R-G relationship can become self-reinforcing. Rising debt may increase perceived risk. Higher perceived risk can raise borrowing costs. Higher borrowing costs increase debt service costs, which can push debt higher still. The reverse can also occur. Stronger growth and lower borrowing costs can improve debt dynamics, reducing pressure on government finances. This is why debt sustainability is better understood as a dynamic process than as a single threshold. Japan illustrates the point. It has sustained a very high debt-to-GDP ratio for decades, supported by unusually low interest rates, a large domestic investor base, and other institutional factors. That does not mean any country could safely sustain the same ratio under different conditions. The lesson is simple: there is no magic debt number. The arithmetic depends on the system around it. The government's options. When debt becomes difficult to sustain, governments have several options. Run primary surpluses. Spend less than revenue. This directly reduces debt, but usually requires spending cuts, higher taxes, or both. Extend maturities. Borrow for longer periods to reduce refinancing risk. Keep interest rates low. This can reduce debt service costs, although it can create other economic distortions. Sell assets. State-owned assets can be sold to reduce debt, although this is usually a one-off solution. Raise taxes. Higher revenue can reduce deficits, but tax increases are politically difficult. Increase productivity and growth. A stronger productive economy increases the income available to service debt, although growth cannot simply be commanded. Allow inflation. Inflation can reduce the real burden of existing nominal debt, but it also reduces purchasing power and can damage confidence. Default or restructure. This can reduce the immediate debt burden, but carries potentially severe economic and financial consequences. Every option has costs. That is why governments tend to prefer borrowing. The benefits of spending are immediate and visible. The costs of accumulated debt arrive later and are distributed across the future. Compound interest does not care which government made the promise. The arithmetic of promises. Debt is only part of the problem. Governments also make promises about future spending. Some are explicit, bonds, loans, and other contractual obligations. Others are implicit or contingent, pensions, healthcare, social security, and other programs whose future costs depend on legislation, demographics, and economic conditions. These obligations can become difficult when the population ages, healthcare costs rise, or the tax base grows slowly. The underlying issue is the same. Future claims must ultimately be supported by future income and production. If promised payments grow faster than the productive economy, something eventually has to change. Taxes, benefits, retirement ages, eligibility, borrowing, inflation, or the promises themselves. The arithmetic does not tell us which political choice will be made. It tells us that choices cannot be avoided forever. The limits of the arithmetic. Compound growth cannot continue indefinitely in a finite physical system. Financial claims can be represented mathematically as exponential functions. The real economy cannot expand without limits because it operates within constraints imposed by resources, energy, demographics, infrastructure, and ecological systems. That does not mean economic progress must stop. It means that growth in physical throughput and growth in economic value are not the same thing. An economy can become more productive without consuming proportionally more resources. Better software, more efficient energy systems, improved logistics, automation, scientific knowledge, and better use of existing infrastructure can all increase output from a given resource base. This distinction is central to the argument of this book. The problem is not growth itself. The problem is building a financial system that requires perpetual expansion of the underlying physical economy to remain stable. Think about it this way. If your debt grows at 4% while your income grows at 2%, the gap compounds against you. You either increase your income, reduce your debt, lower the cost of the debt, or change the terms. The same principle applies at the national level. The productivity alternative. This points toward a different arithmetic, productivity. Growth asks how much larger the economy becomes. Productivity asks how much more effectively the economy uses what it already has. That distinction becomes increasingly important in a world where resources are constrained and automation can dramatically increase the amount of output produced by each unit of labor, capital, energy, or material. A productivity-based economy does not require every improvement to come from consuming more resources. It can create value through efficiency, innovation, automation, knowledge, and better allocation. This is the foundation of the productivity economy proposed in this book. The productivity bond is designed around the same principle. Rather than tying financial returns solely to the expansion of the economy, it links them to measurable improvements in productivity. If the economy becomes more efficient, investors participate in the gains. If productivity weakens, returns adjust accordingly. The result is a different relationship between finance and the real economy. Financial claims are connected not simply to how much bigger the economy becomes, but to how much better it becomes at using what it has. That is the arithmetic of tomorrow. The arithmetic of compound interest is unforgiving because financial claims can compound indefinitely on paper. The physical economy cannot. The challenge is therefore not to defeat mathematics, but to design a financial system whose mathematics is compatible with the world in which it operates.